the quota for the specific types of products they made was right around 300 a day. That was kind of the mark. Like, hopefully the new hires that we're placing with them can hit that mark. And so within about 2 weeks, some of the people that we had placed there, mostly from Burma, they were hitting 600. A couple of them were hitting 900 a day. And then after just a couple weeks of...
Welcome to the Automate and Grow podcast, brought to you by Cloud Advisory.
This is another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast, and my guest today is Chris Chansey from Amplio Recruiting. And Chris is in Atlanta, Georgia, and he is in an interesting space, and he's writing, actually he's got a book that's coming out called The Refugee Workforce, which might tip my hand a little bit to what Chris does, but I'm going to let him talk about it. So Chris, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we were talking before, and you have kind of an interesting business model based around one particular group of people. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so we, about 5 years ago, realized there were a lot of companies looking to hire dependable people. And my wife and I had moved into a refugee resettlement community just outside of downtown Atlanta, Georgia, and realized there were a lot of people that were our neighbors that were looking for good jobs and couldn't seem to find it. And so we started connecting the dots and decided to start a business as a staffing company to leverage that. And it's been an interesting ride for sure.
So it's been 5 years now, and you guys, I know, have had quite a bit of success in this space. What was the initial reaction when you started, first of all, I guess, approaching potential employers?
Yeah, it's been interesting. 5 years ago, if I were to say to someone that we were helping refugees get jobs or that they should consider hiring refugees at their company, for the most part, most Americans would not really be able to articulate what a refugee was or what that meant. But certainly since the last 5 years, there's been this onslaught of political rhetoric. And at least in our case, it's provided, the positive of that has provided some education to America at large. And so you have more companies and specifically individuals who have a better sense of what it means to be a refugee. Now, there may be some misunderstandings and misconceptions conveyed by the media coverage. So we deal with that. But most often now in conversations, we're not saying, let me tell you what a refugee is. It's more about, here's the benefits that maybe you've never realized.
And now what are the benefits that you communicated? And I'm curious the response initially and now how, if anything's changed since then.
Right. So many times I think when we as Americans are engaged in whatever media outlet that we have, in print and news, whatever it could be, most often what we see is that refugees are put into two buckets. Either they're considered a charity case, and we need to think about what ways we can support them financially or in other regards. And there's a lot of nonprofit work that's done to provide support. Or the other bucket is they're considered a terrorist threat, and we need to be very closely watching them because we're concerned that they may have motives for our country and for our communities that could have. That could have, sorry about that, I think I lost you for a second. That could have a damaging impact. And so so we just recognize there's actually a third bucket that I would say 99.9% of them fall into, which is the fact they're a workforce and they truly desire to have an impact in a local on the local community and provide value. They were working before they were displaced in wherever, whatever their host country or host home was. And so for now, for them to get back to finding that dignity through work and get back to just being able to consistently provide for their family is a really high value. And so they want to be able to do that. And then as a result, pay taxes and participate in the community, allow their children to access great education. So companies specifically see a huge impact. And so most recent studies, show an increase in retention. That's almost double what you see in the industry standard right now. So for our company, in staffing, typically what you see is about 40% of the people placed at a company will still be working after 3 months. So 10 people started a company, four of them are still around after 3 months. And for the people who are in HR or business owners out there, you hear that stat and you say, actually, yeah, that's sad, but it's true. Whereas we see right at 80%. So 8 out of 10 people we place will still be engaged after the 3 month mark.
And, oh, wow.
And in many cases,
normally well it's 40%, but right. 80% with that workforce.
Right. There's just a greater motivation to provide for the family and, you know, willing. I mean, they've been through a lot already. So the willingness to persevere is really high. And so we see that. And then the other big stats are retention increases, but you also see productivity increases. And that in many ways, you just think about some of the obstacles and challenges facing the current American workforce. You know, drug abuse is at an all-time high. And there's so many factors that contribute to just overall low production. And so we've seen people go into companies. We have one company here locally in the Atlanta area that manufactures baby products. And the quota for the specific types of products they made was right around 300 a day. That was kind of the mark. Like, hopefully the new hires that we're placing with them can hit that mark. And so within about 2 weeks, some of the people that we had placed there, mostly from Burma, they were hitting 600, a couple of them were hitting 900 a day. And then after just a couple of weeks, and this is like a really great environment. It's not a sweatshop by any means. They're playing music and they're rolling around in their chairs and enjoying, you know, speaking their language, speaking English, learning English. It's just a matter of them being fully engaged and motivated to dial in and make things happen.
So you mentioned a couple countries. What are some of the typical countries where you're seeing people apply for? I assume they apply for refugee status, they're granted it, and then they have the ability to work in the country, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they'll be resettled through the United Nations, UNHCR, and they actually are vetted a couple different ways. But you know, the last process is through Homeland Security for the U.S. And so, you know, at this point, there's jokes made that, you know, it's harder to join. It's harder to come in our country as a refugee than it is to join the FBI. So they go through a very intensive vetting process. And once they land in the U.S., they're legal to work. And so we do, you know, as our company, we do all the e-verifying background checks to provide that assurance to the employers that we work with. But yeah, so you have individuals coming from Southeast Asia, such as Burma, just mentioned, and Bhutan. You have individuals coming from the Middle East, from Syria, from Afghanistan, from Iraq. Some of those specifically served with the U.S. military. And so they have been granted special visas to resettle in the U.S. And so certainly the farthest thing you could think of from potential terrorists, these are individuals who fought alongside our troops and feel very grateful for, you know, what the U.S. has done to care for them and their family. And then you have individuals from all over Africa as well. Congo being the most populated here in the U.S. and then Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, several countries in East Africa as well. So it's a mix, certainly, but various cultures and backgrounds, various levels of education, that all make for really great opportunities, really great employees, really great members of society. And so we love to see how that mix fleshes itself out in the workplace.
And presumably people are, for the most part, coming here for a better way of life and to take advantage of the freedoms that they have. So it makes sense that they would be motivated and excited to be in a situation that's probably very, well, number one, a lot safer than wherever they came from. And even a low, you know, what we can consider maybe a lower standard of living would be very high for them, probably, I'm assuming, from some of the places you've mentioned anyway.
Sure. Yeah, I would say the number one desire is for greater stability. And so that can come in many forms. Yeah, exactly.
Syria alone, like that's been insane.
Yeah, it is. And you know, for many people who were very well educated, you know, certainly their challenges in some ways maybe even be greater, because they did enjoy a certain standard of living that may be very difficult to get back to, where you have others who were already in a job in which the physical labor was required. And that may be the path for them when they arrive in the U.S. may be to, you know, to start at that kind of level. Most of the companies we work with are manufacturing, construction, hospitality jobs. These are jobs that you typically see harder to fill from the American workforce as it currently stands. So right now in the U.S., we have over 7 million open jobs. Right at 4 million of those are manufacturing and hospitality.
Wow.
And so those will go in, those are projected to go unfilled. It's a massive number. And so even if we took every, American who is of age to work and has the ability to work, we still fall very far short of filling the number of open positions that are currently on the market. And so, so having access to legal employees who have a great desire to work and are motivated and can provide great economic impact is almost a no-brainer, right? Let's give them that opportunity to access the marketplace and be able to provide value.
So is that mostly what you're seeing, is like labor-focused opportunities? Is there kind of a skilled workforce that is coming over as well? Like, I guess it's, you know, depends on your definition of skilled, but.
Oh yeah, there certainly are. And the percentage is much lower. And there's certainly going to be some hurdles. You know, we talk about hurdles because there are things that can be overcome with a little bit of communication and effort versus roadblocks that are completely impassable. So, you know, of course, you know, think about fluency in English. In almost every case, there's going to have to be some effort made there. Obviously, some people have learned English from a young age. But for the most part, no matter your level of education, there's going to be some adaptation on your language fluency, transportation. Again, no matter your skill level, you're going to have to figure that hurdle out. But it's certainly something that can be overcome pretty quickly. And a job is a big factor in that, right? If you have stable employment, getting a down payment on a car and getting a driver's license is something that can happen pretty quickly. So, so various skill levels. And for the most part, we work with individuals who have lower skill, or at least skill that directly relates to the American marketplace. Those that have higher skill, for the most part, they have a little bit of an easier road in finding work, more white collar type work that's suitable for them.
And then how or what markets do you operate in? I know you're obviously in Atlanta, and I think there's a couple other markets that you work.
Right. Yeah. So right now we started in Atlanta, and then we have three other markets. We're in Raleigh, Durham. We're in Houston and in Dallas, and we'll be expanding into a couple other markets later this year in Philadelphia and in Nashville. And our goal is to be in 25 locations around the country by 2025. Oh, wow.
So then are these all like, where, how does it work with a refugee? Like, are they told where they have to settle, or are they choosing? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. Most of the time they are being told where they're going to be. In some cases, they're in a refugee camp somewhere in the world, and they're basically in a lottery system, and their name gets posted up on a tree, and they have the opportunity to jump on the next flight. In many cases, that means they're taking a loan from the U.S. government to pay for that flight, and they're expected to pay that back within a couple years of being in the U.S. Then they would be told where they're going to resettle. So you have individuals from Africa who've never seen snow, who are landing in Minneapolis and having to learn how to cope with completely different environment. You've got people all over. When they get to the U.S., though, they're obviously free to move and if they have family and they have the capacity to do so financially, you know, many times you see people moving to where they have greater support networks.
And do you have an idea of like how many people a year are would fit this category? Like what's the opportunity for you to help new people a year? Or I mean, I'm sure that it's not a one-time thing, but.
Right. Yeah. So just kind of the overall scale. So there's a, over the last 20 to 30 years, there's been close to 2 million refugees resettled in the U.S. But significantly higher numbers in the previous administration, under the previous administration, and really kind of starting with George W. Bush, we saw the numbers begin to spike. So we were at a point where the U.S. was resettling, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 refugees a year. And that number was predicted to continue to increase as the need around the world has increased. And then that number's actually dropped quite a bit, of course, under the current administration. And so so the projection is probably close to 20,000, less than half of what was projected. And I think it's going to actually end up being well below that number, maybe 15. So like in the whole state of Georgia, we'll resettle 1,500 people this year, as opposed to close to 10,000 just a couple of years ago.
Okay. So that's interesting. I think we all talk in generality. So it's interesting to hear the numbers and understand the scale and how maybe different policies affect it. So,
And I think it's interesting the juxtaposition of the fact that we want our economy to thrive, but at the same time, we're limiting. It doesn't seem like it's being talked about nearly enough, the fact that if we don't fill open jobs, then it is going to affect the economy in some way. Now, it may not be significant, but there is some stagnation that will have an impact in the long term if we don't correctly identify that we need. You know, think about trade schools or the enrollment is much much lower than it ever has been in the history of those programs in the United States. There's been some reports recently that maybe Gen Z is going to continue to kind of pick up on that and maybe enroll a little bit more. But reality is there's a huge gap. And sure. and solving that 20 years from now is going to be way too late. But as of today, there are individuals who want to take those jobs if we give them that opportunity.
Are you seeing skilled trades as part of what you're trying to place? Like you're trying to place people in construction jobs, like, or, you know, trades, like, I guess there's bricklaying and there's roofing and then there's electrical. Are there those?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Those are, there's a massive need. Right now the stat is that for every five people that leave those trades, so five people that maybe are retiring, or are leaving those trades, only one person is filling their spot. So
I'll have to edit that. My TV decided to start going off.
No problem. Off there, yeah, so the stat is that for every five people that leave the trades, only one person is filling their place.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
So it's an alarming rate of you know, exit, and there's no real plan of how to fix that. So one of our partners we partner with is a career training program specifically designed for refugees. We actually share office space with them in Atlanta, and they're looking to grow into other markets as well. But they've historically done training in electrical and pipe fitting and welding, apartment maintenance, they have various programs to do that. And certainly trade schools and tech schools are trying to fill that gap, but there needs to be a lot more support to make that happen.
Yeah. And those are important roles. I mean, and they're typically like, they're pretty, you know, well-paying professions once you get into them, right? And they take, those are like skilled labor roles as opposed to just, I guess, manual labor. So those are long-term economic generators, I think. So having people in those roles are really important. Like, and I
absolutely,
it's interesting what you said about, you know, let's say non-refugees, but like, you know, native or people that are from the system here, like the Gen Z you were mentioning, I guess it's a question mark. I mean, are they going to fill those roles? Like,
right.
There's like a real bias maybe towards tech or, you know, white collar type work, right? So
right.
Probably accounting for a lot of that trend.
Yeah, another kind of alarming statistic that we've seen in this research of working on the book is men who are between the ages of 25 and 55 are exiting the workforce dramatically. So individuals who grew up in the U.S., they've been educated, many of them, you know, at college level. And so that 25 to 55, there's a dramatic exit. And so it's being called a disappearing workforce. And the question is, where are they going? What are they going? What are they doing? And so what you see is,
they're going to play video games is what they're doing.
Right. I mean, exactly.
Which is totally something different, but I think this is what people don't get, that they are opting out of higher education, which is a different subject than what we're talking about. If you look at the split in colleges from 20 years ago to now, it used to be like 50-50 in most colleges, right? Men to women. Right now it's like 60-40 women. And a lot of it has to do with debt that's unforgivable and, you know, no perceived value of the benefit of being in that debt. Plus schooling before that, that is, you know, definitely got a slant, right? So men are opting out. And I think the great secret is that they're going into this other electronic world. And that's not a movie. That's not like a joke. It's actually an economy,
right?
It's a big economy. Like there's hundreds and hundreds of millions of people in that economy, predominantly male. And so they're not tracking that. Mm-hmm. It's not just esports. Like there's a digital economy around it. And
right.
I know as well as I do, like I don't participate in it, but I'm smart enough to know it's there.
Right.
So to your point, well, what about all these real world things? There has to be probably people with a more traditional mindset that maybe aren't, you know, going to be in that aspect of the economy, right?
Right. Yeah. It's definitely flying under the radar. It's hard to kind of show, all right, well, where are they now spending their time? But some of the research does show that the bulk of them, over 50% of them, are claiming disability on their unemployment. And so it's hard to say that that's truly the case. And so certainly there's a rise of opioid use and drug abuse. But it's hard to really connect the dots on exactly where they're going and what's happening. So, but there certainly is an electronic world that's really engaging and, is certainly part of the process. So.
Yeah, and that's another unfortunate aspect. And it's questionable if anyone drilled down what's actually going on there. Like the level of disability is kind of alarming too. So, but I think it's the opposite of what we're seeing from the workforce you're talking about, which is they're hungry, they want to contribute, and they want a better life. They want the ability to feel productive and do something of value, right?
Right. And I think that the traditional barriers to employment, I think those are being removed, that they are legal. And yeah, there's going to be some sacrifices that a company makes in terms of maybe a slightly longer onboarding process, maybe provide a little bit more visuals and demonstrations over just purely, language transfer. But I think if some companies are willing to make some of those small sacrifices in the front end, they see this massive positive return on that by engaging with the refugee workforce.
Makes total sense. Well, listen, I want to be conscious of your time, Chris. So I'm going to ask you a few questions and we can wrap up. This has been really interesting and definitely eye-opening for me. So you're definitely a different guest than I've had in the past. So I really appreciate the different perspective. And I applaud what you're doing. It's really interesting. So the first thing I'll ask is, how do people get in touch with you and what's the best way to reach out?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So folks can engage us online and certainly on social media. Don't quit your job to do that, but you can definitely engage us online. So, you know, we're posting pretty actively on our Instagram on at Amplio Recruit. So Amplio, A-M-P-L-I-O. And then, you know, of course, engage us on our website. If you're a company looking to hire and just curious about potential ways to integrate the refugee workforce in your company, whether or not we end up working together, we'd love to talk with you and just be a resource. So you can connect with us at AmplioRecruiting.com. And then we've got the book coming out in the fall. And so for those who are just interested and want to learn more about that, even helping us with the launch of the book, all that will be available at RefugeeWorkforce.com.
RefugeeWorkforce.com. And you think that's coming out in the fall?
Yeah, that's the plan. We just completed the last chapter. And so we're going through final edits over the next month or so. And then we should be able to be purchased on Amazon, shooting for October. So we'll see.
That's great. So I'm gonna wrap with two more questions. One is, and I'm sure we can anticipate some of this because you're doing some interesting work, but how are you changing the world?
Yeah, it's a big question.
It's a big question.
I think at the very heart of it, our goal is just to help help people have a different perspective when it comes to refugee and that term, and really getting people out of their kind of sheltered perspective that they just immediately adopt from reading something or hearing something through the media. Go and meet someone, hear their story. And trying to create a different narrative that it's not a charity case, it's not a terrorist threat, but these are individuals who really want to add value. And so I hope that's really the core of what we're trying to do. Certainly we're giving people jobs. 800 refugees, you know, got full-time employment through us just this past year in 2018, 74 different companies over this past year. So those things are really exciting. I think the core of it is just helping overall as a country recognize there's value and there's incredible opportunity if we're willing to accept that.
Love it. That's definitely, again, you're coming from a very unique perspective that we haven't had on the podcast before. So I really appreciate you joining us. So the final part is when we have interesting guests on the podcast, we ask you to nominate other interesting guests. And I'd like to know who you would like to nominate to be a future guest of the Automate and Grow podcast.
Oh man, great question. We love making connections, and I think there's a few that come to mind. So one I think would be really interesting. A close friend of ours is an organization called Care for AIDS, and Justin Miller is the founder, and he also has a book coming out this fall and is doing a great job of just continuing to provide education around the whole HIV crisis. It's kind of faded in terms of kind of the media kind of report, but it's still very much an issue that needs to be addressed around the world. And then I think there are some other, you know, great kind of social impact companies that we work closely with that would make for great material. There's Blusion is the name of a laundry company, and you think of a kind of a somewhat boring type of industry, but they're hiring refugees at a really high rate and integrating them into their workforce. And that's been really exciting to see that happen. Another great social impact company is called Next Door Photos. They do commercial real estate, residential real estate photography. So we'd love to make some connections on some really neat companies
that work alongside. Well, so we're going to start with Justin Miller, right?
Yes.
Okay, Justin Miller, you've been nominated by Chris to be a future guest on the Automate and Grow podcast. We will accept that nomination and we will follow up with you.
Great. Thanks for the time, Michael.
No problem. Thank you very much for joining. This has been another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast.
This has been an episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. Check out other episodes for interesting topics on how to grow, innovate, and automate your business.